Today is Monday, January 30th. We're going to be working on more blood information today. Okay, so we're going to take a look at page 25 with leukocytes. We know that leukocytes fall in two categories. They are classified either as granulocytes or as agranulocytes. What's the obvious difference?
Granules,
good. And of course, the granulocytes have them. The agranulocytes typically lack the granules, or at least they're very hard to see if they in fact are there. So we know that granulocytes and agranulocytes are divided among the lack or presence of those granules. Let's talk about the granulocytes first in terms of our leukocytes. The granulocytes are typically a little bigger than red blood cells, big round cells in shape. And they oftentimes don't live very long, often not more than a few hours to a few days in time. Let me put it to you this way. If your job as a granulocyte is to eat the enemy, then you yourself die after eating the enemy. So no wonder there's not a very long lifespan for those granulocytes. So eating the enemy means that you're a phagocyte by nature. That means that you engulf and take in bacteria, viruses, even cancer cells or dead cells and debris in your body. So all of this process of eating the bad stuff takes a toll, and that's why we often have to replace them. The granulocytes are lovers, and they love certain stain colors. So the neutrophils, basophils, and eosinophils are all named after the stain color that they prefer. So let's take the neutrophils first. Their stain color preference is in fact a light blue, light pink, or light purple. And then I show you a picture that doesn't look like any of those. I show you a picture that has a really bright pink background. But that's not the typical for a neutrophil. Usually it's a very light, pale colored stain. So since the stain kind of lies to us in this picture, something else you can use to identify your neutrophil is the number of lobes. So what's the typical number for a neutrophil?
3 to 5.
Yeah, so the nucleus should have 3 to 5 lobes. And of course, this one fits the bill. Number one job for a neutrophil is to do what?
Eat cells.
Good. Eat cells, yeah, dead cells, bacteria, okay? So, you know, sometimes people go and have a sinus infection. They'll get a round of antibiotics. They take the whole round of antibiotics. They go home a couple weeks later. They still don't feel very good. They go back once again. They say, I don't think my sinus infection is gone. And if they are really interested in what's going on, they may in fact do a blood test to see what's going on with the blood cell count. If you have a high level of neutrophils, we know there's a bacterial infection or perhaps something of that sort hiding somewhere in your body that's not perhaps readily available to see. So neutrophil populations are going to be the ones that rise with infections, especially with bacterial infections. You'll want to note on your worksheet, they are the most common of our white blood cells. Okay, most numerous or most common of our white blood cells. This neutrophil looks more like your typical one should. It has the 3-lobe nucleus and it has a pale colored background. That's more what we would expect to see for your typical neutrophil. And another one that looks like it pretty much fits the bill, there's those 3-lobe nuclei, pretty pale looking background. That's again, that's normally what we would expect to see. Let's see. Let's do that for a minute. That eosinophil, I want you to see the granule colors there. The granules in the eosinophil should stain what color?
Red.
Yeah. Yeah, red for the eosinophil. There's a really pretty eosinophil. Very nice red granules. Sometimes they have a bright pink or an orange color to them. So it should look very distinctive from the other two types of granulocytes. How about the nucleus shape for an eosinophil? Two lobes, bilobe. Good. And this one does fit the bill also. It's got, whoops, got the same number of lobes that we would expect to see. Okay. So what do eosinophils do for a living?
Parasites.
Allergies and parasites. Okay. So let's talk about those two in terms of nowadays. Go back 150 years in time, and they say that allergies were far less common back through history than they are now. Nowadays, I'm not imagining that everybody in here either has allergies or knows someone with allergies, and we're allergic to everything from dust to foods to, you know, cockroach, you know, dust. I mean, just practically everything you could think of can cause an allergy. So why nowadays do you think we have more allergies than, say, people did 150 years ago?
We're cleaner.
They
get exposed to everything.
They're exposed to everything, yeah. So what do you think the eosinophils have to say about all this? I'm bored. Give me something to kill, right? Okay, and so what were they used to killing?
Parasites,
right. Okay, so if you live in a clean environment, you don't have parasites, your eosinophils don't have anything really constructive to do. So along comes some mold, and your eosinophils say, hey, that looks like a lot of fun, let's kill it, because it's here all the time in your system. So let's go nuts and go really, like, ape crazy over killing the mold. Well, there's where an allergy comes from. It's a hypersensitivity to something like a normal antigen that we're commonly exposed to. So we see that the eosinophils might, in fact, not have enough to do, or they may, in fact, be hypersensitized because we do live in a chemical-laden and clean environment. Those two things don't sound like they go together, do they? So we clean a lot, right? We've got a lot of chemicals that we clean with, and yet that causes a clean environment full of chemicals. So the combination of those two is what we actually think is promoting those eosinophils to produce such deadly allergies to things like foods, shrimp, you know, eggs, peanuts, and then all sorts of other common stuff like mold and dust. There is a hygiene hypothesis movement out there that says, let's try giving people who have really severe allergies some parasitic worm infections. Why in the world? Give the eosinophils something to do, right? Okay? So they've actually tried giving small parasitic worm infections up under the skin where it's more or less harmless. You know, we don't want to give you a tapeworm infection in your intestines, but give it to you up under the skin where it's more likely not going to cause problems. And then we're going to see, okay, does this give the eosinophils something to do every day besides attack these random and strange things like mold spores that come in contact with your body? So that is actually a movement out there among the immunology world, is to see if we can do something to give these eosinophils a hobby besides attacking our allergens. So, strange little cells there. The last of our granulocyte category are the basophils. And what color are their granules stained?
Purple
and blue. Good. They should have a 2 to 3 lobe nucleus. And what are these granules full of? Histamine, yeah. So these are the least common of your white blood cells, but yet they release histamine. And what does histamine do when you have an allergic reaction? Makes you go crazy, right? Itchy eyes, watery eyes, swollen nose. If you have a mosquito bite, the histamine reaction that occurs with that is itchy skin. So when we have allergies, we normally take an antihistamine, and that is to block the basophil action. So one thing about these basophils, if a lot of them release their histamine granules simultaneously, it makes your blood capillaries very leaky. And what that means is your blood plasma leaks into your surrounding cells and tissues, and no longer does that blood plasma travel in your bloodstream. Guess what happens to your blood pressure? Drops, yeah. And so this is a form of shock called what? Anaphylactic, yeah. This gives a person anaphylactic shock. So interesting that our least common of all blood cells can cause death in us. It's kind of amazing. But yeah, you can actually have these things wholeheartedly dump their histamine granules and produce a case of shock. Okay. So what do you think? A bacterial infection is most likely linked to which one of these?
Neutrophils.
Yeah, neutrophils, right? Because their job is to eat and get rid of bacteria. Okay. Let's talk about the agranulocytes. What are they missing?
Granules.
Now, in fact, they may have a few, but for the most part, they're either difficult to see or just not there at all. The two in this category are your lymphocytes and monocytes. And so those lymphocytes do have a very large, round nucleus. You know, it stains dark purple or dark blue, and it takes up almost the entire space of that cell. So what do lymphocytes do for us? Yeah, they do fight infection. They are also the ones that build antibodies. You may recall those are the Y-shaped proteins that bind and agglutinate antigens. In fact, there's two kinds of lymphocytes. There's B cells and T cells. The T cells are matured in your thymus gland and your tonsils, and the B cells are matured in your bone marrow. So, you know, you may wonder what happens after puberty when we no longer have a thymus. Those T cells would in fact then be matured in your tonsils. So another good reason not to have them taken out, you've got to have those tonsils to help mature T cells once you get past a certain age. So T cells are great for fighting infection. The B cells are the ones that help to make antibodies so you can have long-term recognition of what you've encountered. You know, you don't want to have the flu every single year or something else like a cold. So these, if it's the same exact virus that comes in contact with you, you've got an army built of antibodies against those very specific antigens. So monocytes are also agranulocytes. How would you describe the nucleus shape? Like a kidney bean, somewhat U-shaped. I see Pac-Man. Okay, so any of those would work. It's not a big round nucleus like what we just saw with lymphocytes. Here's one for comparison. But most of those monocytes have an indentation in them that make the nucleus look somewhat kidney bean, U-shaped, or even Pac-Man shaped. So I like the Pac-Man aspect because if you've ever played the video game, Pac-Man eats stuff, right? So these particular cells can transform into big eaters called phagocytes. And they travel through your cells and tissues looking for anything they might be able to munch on. So these are active phagocytes eating and cleaning up your body, traveling throughout your cells and tissues. Unfortunately, one, go ahead, Natalie.
Well, I was going to ask, like, you were telling us how the granulocytes were staining. Is that one staining like 4 years
blue? That's it, yeah. Both lymphocytes and monocytes are going to have that blue-purple stain, and that's pretty much it. So the only way to distinguish those two agranulocytes is to look for the shape of the nucleus. So color is not going to really be a help here.
Okay, so we don't really need to worry about the color.
Don't worry about the color, yep. Have you guys heard of the Epstein-Barr virus? You've heard of mono, the kissing disease? That's the Epstein-Barr virus. Okay, so college campuses where people live in dorms or in apartments in close, you know, close quarters where people may share drinks, they may just be around a lot of people quite often, it's easy for that virus to be transmitted. And what happens is that monocyte is cleaning up the place and happens to eat an Epstein-Barr virus, and now it becomes infected, causing a disease called mono or mononucleosis. Mono, of course, from the monocyte. All viruses that you get, you keep forever. They're yours. You know, you may kill their activity, but they're always going to sit dormant somewhere in your system. It takes months to make this particular virus go dormant, and in fact, you may suffer the long-term effects of Epstein-Barr. Do you know what it can cause? You heard of chronic fatigue syndrome? Okay, chronic fatigue syndrome, they say, is linked to the presence of Epstein-Barr that can't be crushed. So even though you may get rid of mono, you may still have the lagging, blah, lack of energy that comes from having had those monocytes infected. So interesting stuff there about those monocytes. Keep in mind the most common to least common. Neutrophils are your most common cell type in terms of leukocytes. What is your least common white blood cell?
Basophils.
Basophils, good. So you may remember that never let monkeys eat bananas is a good way to do it. That gives you the order from most common white blood cell to least common white blood cell. Did you need that previous picture?
Yeah.
Was it that one? Okay. Okay. How you doing with these white blood cells? Pretty good? You got any questions on them? Let me remind you that overall, the most common cell type is not the leukocyte, but instead is what?
Red blood.
Red blood cell, right. And overall, the least common cell type of any cell is?
Leukocyte.
Leukocyte, yeah. So, of course, erythrocytes outnumber the leukocytes about 10 to 1. So, big difference there in their population numbers. The last of our categories are the thrombocytes, which are otherwise known as platelets. And they look like little tiny cell fragments in this picture. All right, so they form in your bone marrow, just like every other blood cell does, and they form from a really big multi-nucleated cell called a megakaryocyte. Let me show you what that looks like. Looks like a bruise, doesn't it? Okay. So this big cell here in the center is a megakaryocyte. It's got many nuclei, it's really big, and it leaks away little platelets that enter the bloodstream. I kind of think of them as forming the way you would form a balloon. If you blow up a balloon, it's really big. If you blow it so far that it burst, you have now all these little tiny fragments all over the floor. That's what the platelets are, simply little fragments that come from the rupture of this megakaryocyte. What's the main job of a platelet?
Blood clotting,
good. They only live 10 days. Why so short? Do you think they have a brain?
No.
No brain here. No organelles here. They're just simply cell fragments, and so they really can't think about what they're doing, so no way to repair them if they're damaged. You'll notice the normal blood cell count there is about 150,000 to around 350,000 in a cubic millimeter of blood. So they do wear out quickly, and they're constantly being replaced by new ones formed from your bone marrow. Let me give you a moment to jot down the lifespan and the normal cell count on the bottom of your page. So I'd like to talk to you about some disorders before we get into blood clotting, and the disorders are listed over on page 26. Okay, top of page 26. We've got either red blood cell disorders or white blood cell disorders on this page. Red blood cell disorders have endings of emia. That's the general rule. And most of our white blood cell disorders have some kind of leuko prefix. That's the general rule once again. Let's first talk about the red blood cell disorder known as anemia. What's going on with the red blood cells if anemia is the diagnosis?
Not carrying enough oxygen.
Not carrying enough oxygen, right. So let's think about what a red blood cell is made from. A red blood cell has no nucleus, has very few organelles, but it does have lots and lots of hemoglobin molecules. So tell me about the construction of a hemoglobin molecule. What's in there? Got iron, sure.
B12.
Got to need B12 to make it, right? Heme groups and globin groups, right? So there's proteins in there. There's a heme group that supports the iron molecule. If you've got any problem with any portions of that, whether it's B12, folic acid, iron, globin chains, heme groups, then you may have difficulty transporting adequate levels of oxygen. So the word anemia is kind of a big generic term that simply means difficulty transporting oxygen. We really want to know the specifics here as to why there's difficulty transporting oxygen. So a couple of them are listed there on your worksheet. I'd like to go over those with you first. This one's called iron deficiency anemia, and I'm not sure if you can see it from where you're sitting, but there's a lot of red blood cells here that look kind of spiky in appearance. That comes from having misshapen hemoglobin due to the lack of iron. So there's a number here that look like they have little spiked edges all the way around. Who do you think's more at risk for this, men or women?
Women.
Women, good. What age group of women?
Menstruating
women, right. Some women sit on the borderline of having just enough red blood cells to transport oxygen. Every month that she menstruates, she dips a little over into that iron deficiency anemia territory. So a lot of women are kind of pulled into that iron deficiency territory due to menstruation. If a female has heavy periods early in her teenage years, she may never get out of that iron deficiency loop and may suffer from it throughout her 20s, 30s, and 40s, and so on. So, simple way to solve this problem, right? What would you provide? Iron, right. Don't want to take too much of that stuff, but of course you can take iron supplements to help increase the number of red blood cells and help get rid of that spiky appearance that you see here. Another form of sickle cell, or another form of anemia rather, is sickle cell anemia. And this particular one is a genetic condition that we can follow through parents and children generation after generation. So the case of this particular disorder is a recessive allele, which means that you may be walking around as a carrier and not have the full-blown symptoms of sickle cell anemia. It takes two parents that are either carriers or full-blown with sickle cell to produce a child with sickle cell anemia. So if you've got two carrier parents that somewhat look normal, you have a 25% chance of producing a child with sickle cell anemia. We know that red blood cells should have what shape?
Concave.
Yeah, biconcave discs, right. So what is up with the sickle cell?
Elongated.
Elongated. Imagine that traveling through your capillaries. Red blood cells have to be flexible, and if they're like long spikes, no wonder people with this condition have fever, inflammation, pain in the joints, tired and fatigue. You know, all that comes from these cells not being able to transport adequate oxygen levels. Interesting, it is a single amino acid in the hemoglobin structure that is at fault here for making these cells have a rather sickled shape. So what population do you think is at highest risk for this? African background, right. If you have an African background, you're more likely to have this running through your genetics than others, but there's actually genetic advantage to having sickle cell anemia. Malaria. So if you happen to have sickle cell anemia, malaria has a very difficult time infecting your cells, and so you're more malaria resistant than others who don't have sickle cell anemia. This is called pernicious anemia. It is a vitamin B12 deficiency. So what is the relationship between B12 and red blood cells? You got to have it to make those red blood cells, right? So if you have low levels of vitamin B12, then you may have a low population of course, red blood cells. So where do you get B12 from? What kind of foods? Animal products and meats, right. Egg yolks are another good source of it. So if you don't eat meat products or eggs, then that's one way to, of course, rob yourself of the B12 needed. And in that case, you would need either some kind of injection supplement or oral supplement of B12. This is not compatible with long-term longevity. This is a deteriorating process that would cause somebody to eventually die. So in a case of vitamin B12 deficiency, we would want to make sure nowadays that we adequately supplement and get B12 into the body. So nowadays we actually create our own problems. bypass surgery that bypasses the stomach for weight loss actually can induce vitamin B12 deficiency. So, hey, we create our own problems, right? So in the case of that, we would also need to supplement with some kind of B12 injections or pills.
I got a question.
Sure.
I'm a vegetarian and I take the vitamins, so is that I'm still getting?
You can be tested for anemia to see if you're getting adequate levels. And they do other things in the blood test, like.
I will tell you this. I got a lot of dizzy spells and my vision was blurred and I looked up the B12 deficiency.
That's symptoms.
And see, that's when I started taking the vitamins, and I feel it's like I'm starting to feel a world of difference after I started taking the vitamins. And
yeah.
I didn't know, I didn't even think about that when I first, you know, became a vegetarian, that that could be something that would play a factor.
Yeah. They can look at not just your red blood cell population,
right,
but other factors to confirm or say that you don't have it. Yeah, that dizziness is certainly a symptom.
Because it matched up with everything that they were saying, but
yeah,
once I started taking that vitamin, like you were talking about, the oral,
so if you feel okay, then you know you wonder, probably, are you okay?
Yeah. Yeah, because my mom said the same thing. She's like, well, you still need to go get your blood checked. I'm like,
But if you don't feel dizzy and you don't have the fatigue or the tiredness coming
with it. No, I feel a lot better than what I did, but I wonder if that has something to do with it, because I got where I was real dizzy and my vision kind of got.
Certainly makes you suspect, because knowing the link between the foods.
And like I said, because I don't, you know, I eat a lot of veggies and all, but I don't eat meat.
Right. That sounds like a pretty likely link there, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So let's go to the other end of the spectrum. Let's go back to our original screen. Polycythemia is a condition of excess red blood cells, and so that can come from two different issues, either living life at a high altitude, or it could come from bone marrow cancer. Either way, because there's so many extra red blood cells, they do classify this as bone marrow cancer. Okay? So let me show you the picture of polycythemia. You'll notice a normal population there on the left, and then the massive crowding here, normal population on the right, massive crowding here on the left. The crowding is the issue because, like we talked earlier, you can crowd out normal healthy populations of even white blood cells, and now you can have a side issue of like anemia or leukemia. So it just kind of balloons into multiple issues if you have polycythemia, especially if it's bone marrow cancer. Let's take the first issue. Why do you think somebody at a high altitude might develop polycythemia?
Lack of oxygen.
Yeah, lack of oxygen. The more red blood cells you've got, the better off you're going to be for transportation. How long do you think living at a high altitude would take before you might develop polycythemia? About a week or two. Yeah. So it only takes about a week or two to make new red blood cells. And so give it a week or two and we start seeing an increase and even more increase of extra red blood cells. You've got to have them to transport the very low oxygen at that high altitude. Any dangers of having polycythemia besides having the extra red blood cells? What does this do to blood viscosity? Thicker, yeah. And then we're going to learn later on that the thicker the blood, the harder your heart has to work, and the higher your blood pressure goes. So certainly issues for us in considering the big picture there.
So what would they give somebody with that, blood thinner?
They could give blood thinner. One easy solution is to simply draw blood every 2 weeks. They could also give a medication that stops or inhibits red blood cell production, you know, inhibits EPO. But blood thinner would be another solution, sure. All right, so let's talk about white blood cells for just a moment. Most of these have some kind of leuko prefix, of course, reminding us of the white blood cell being involved. The first one up there is leukemia, which is a blood cell condition where there's immature cells released into the bloodstream. So if you have something like polycythemia, for instance, that could also cause immature white blood cells to be produced. The problem is when they're put into blood circulation, they're not capable of fighting infection. So what do you think some of the symptoms are of someone with leukemia, the first one there? A lot of infections, flu-like symptoms, Okay, so perhaps not able to get rid of anything that you catch. Achiness, soreness, fatigue, things of that sort can come from that first one up there. Leukopenia is a condition where we have too few white blood cells. They may in fact be mature, but you can actually develop this condition from having taken a lot of corticosteroids to suppress an organ transplant. So those who do have organs that are, you know, received into their body will stay most likely on a lifelong course of corticosteroids, glucocorticoids, right, to suppress their white blood cells from attacking and rejecting that organ transplant. So again, what is their problem? What is the risk that they run? Not enough to fight infection, right? So once again, infection is another risk here. We did talk about the Epstein-Barr virus that's specific to those monocytes that can cause mononucleosis or simply mono. And the last one is one that we most often experience. This is just simply an infection that can cause leukocytosis. That means we have elevated numbers of white blood cells. If it's a bacterial infection, what population do you think will be elevated? Neutrophils, right. What if it's parasites? Eosinophils, good. What if it's allergies? Could be both basophils and eosinophils, yeah. So it depends on what the flavor of the infection is as to which population may see an increase. Okay, so that should take us down there to the bottom of the page. Any questions on those blood cell disorders? Last page here is hemostasis or blood clotting. Let's flip over to page 28. Okay, so blood clotting is a three-step process. The goal here is to stop the bleeding, and so the first step is what we call vascular spasms. Let's say that you've got a fairly innocuous cut, like maybe a paper cut or a shaving cut. And the very first thing to happen is the vessel is going to clamp down and spasm. What's the goal? What are we trying to prevent?
Blood flow.
Yeah, the more blood flows through here, the more you can lose. And so if you've got a pretty bad bleed, you can also put pressure on that area to stop the bleeding. So that is mimicking vascular spasms, and it promotes vasoconstriction. So what is vasoconstriction? Right, vessel gets smaller, it constricts, and the narrowing is what prevents the blood from leaving. So vascular spasms happen first, and the whole goal here is, of course, the first step in stopping the blood from flowing out and exiting that bleed. Let me also make this note that, you know, we're so used to seeing blood flow out of our bodies, but in fact it can flow into our bodies. You can have an internal hemorrhage or blood loss, just as you can have an external hemorrhage or blood loss. So, you know, we're so trained in seeing the external loss, we forget sometimes there's the possibility of an internal bleed. The next step takes around a couple of minutes to occur. This is called the platelet plug formation process. And when you rupture a blood vessel, you've now changed the landscape of that blood vessel. Normally, the blood vessel is lined with simple squamous epithelial tissue. In the background, there are collagen fibers that help reinforce and make that blood vessel strong. Now, when you rupture that vessel, you can see we now have a break in the simple squamous lining, and we have collagen fibers that hang into the ruptured vessel. Chemicals are now released, like serotonin, that encourage platelets traveling through the area to stop and hang out. I kind of think of it like blowing a whistle and saying, okay, everybody calm. So these platelets are responding to that chemical serotonin, and they're clinging to that site of the rupture. Now, under normal conditions, there is no point in having them cling to any portion of the inside of your vessel. That, in fact, would be a very bad thing if they just suddenly decided, hey, you know, flash mob, we're going to cling right here. That's not good, because then you have clots that are formed inside your vessel, and that can cause a stoppage of the blood flow. So only under the condition of having a ruptured vessel should those platelets clean. What's the chemical released by platelets that call for more platelets to come?
Serotonin.
Good. You may have heard of serotonin. It is a blood brain neurotransmitter, and in fact, it's used here for calling for more platelets. This is a positive feedback mechanism. So how does this work? A little serotonin's released, a few platelets come, those platelets release serotonin. Now what happens?
It carries on and on until the blood stops.
Good, carries on and on until the blood flow stops, right. So it's an enhancing or an increasing process. So ultimately, we want enough platelets to clog up that hole temporarily to prevent what from happening? Blood to go out. Yeah, we want to stop the bleeding. So, hey, if the vascular spasms didn't do the job, hopefully the platelet plug will help seal the deal. Now, this is not permanent. Vascular spasms and platelet plug are not a permanent solution. These are temporary solutions for the problem. So what has to happen next is a very complicated process called coagulation. Let me make a point here. Agglutination is not the same thing as coagulation. Let's take a step back. We talked about agglutination in reference to antibodies and antigens, where we actually clump foreign antigens using antibodies. That is agglutination. And it has nothing to do with making blood stop from making the bleeding stop. Coagulation, on the other hand, has a goal of stopping the bleeding and turning your blood from a liquid to a gel-like consistency. If you turn it to jelly, it's going to be hard for it to leak out of your body, right? So there's a number of factors involved in this process that convert and finally make this glass product here. But we're going to look at just these four parts of the process. When you've got bleeding occurring, that's going to allow for us to take those dissolved plasma proteins and now use them for good. Our goal is to take prothrombin and thrombin. Thrombin's an enzyme, and it helps to activate an inactive form of fibrinogen. Keep in mind, what does that gen suffix tell us? New growth, right, to make, to grow, to build. Fibrinogen is the inactive clotting protein that circulates in your bloodstream. All it takes is prothrombin and thrombin to turn it on. And now fibrinogen turns into an active mesh network called fibrin. Fibrin is what makes your blood become a more gel-like quality and less like a liquid. And you say, why do that? Because this is what you want to trap. What if you let all your red blood cells leak out of your body? What can you not do?
Transporting
oxygen is now a problem. So you actually make this fibrin mesh network as a result of coagulation. It turns the blood into a thick gel, and it's kind of like putting up this jelly-like wall that says to the blood cells, hey, you're going no further. You're stuck here in this mesh network. So from the time that you start this process until you coagulate your blood, you're looking at around 3 to 5 minutes time. That's all it takes to coagulate your blood. Okay, so 3 to 5 minutes time, you've broken the blood vessel, it's clotted, it's now coagulated, and the bleeding should have stopped. If you have a severe hemorrhage, sure, it may take longer. It may include you putting pressure on that area, but you know, we want to encourage coagulation because that tells us the blood has turned from a liquid to a gel-like consistency. In severe accidents, you know, somebody may have a femoral artery bleed, and the platelets and the coagulation may in fact stick to their pants. So the first thing we may not want to do is cut their pants off of them, right? Because if you do that, what happens? Bleeding again, right? Then you have to put pressure and restart the whole process. So sometimes if, say, coagulation is occurring to another item, like clothing, then we don't want to remove that clothing to restart the bleeding process. You do the same thing at home with Kleenexes or tissue paper. If you stick that on a bleed and walk around the house for 5 to 10 minutes, and then you say, oh yeah, I forgot to rip that off, and you pull it off, you're pulling off the platelet plug and most likely the coagulated blood too. And then you know what happens? You got to start over. Okay. Thank goodness most bandages, most gauze, does have an inhibitor chemical on there that prevents the platelet plug and coagulation from sticking to the gauze most of the time, right? Okay, so they do put a chemical on there that stops that whole process of sticking. Okay, so I do want to mention to you about midway down your page, it says a couple of chemicals that are needed for clotting. One is vitamin K, and the other one is calcium. Let's talk about where you get vitamin K from. What kind of food groups are high in vitamin K?
Leafy greens.
Leafy greens, right. So if you like your collards and kale and turnip greens and mustard greens, you're in good business for blood clotting to occur properly, because those are great sources of vitamin K. Calcium, of course, is regulated by two hormones. Which hormone raises blood calcium levels? Parathyroid or PTH, good. And of course, calcitonin would act as an antagonist and lower those calcium levels. So yeah, it requires that you have calcium and you have vitamin K for that whole coagulation step to occur. So these red things, of course, being red blood cells, and the spider web is a coagulation web of fibrin. So I wanted to mention to you, just as a side note, that blood serum is actually blood minus the clotting factors. So why do you think we may remove fibrinogen if we're going to store blood for a period of time? So it doesn't clot, yeah. Because left sitting, fibrinogen activates into fibrin in about how many minutes? 3 to 5, yeah. There'd be no point in taking blood if that was the case, right? Well, what we're doing here is we're giving time for your body to heal back that damaged vessel. Once coagulation occurs in about 3 to 5 minutes, your body now starts in the process of growing and repairing the blood vessel. That may take a week or longer. Once, however, you get the blood vessel re-knitted, you don't need a clot hanging out on the inside of your blood vessel. So we must have fibrinolysis to occur. Keep in mind, what does the lysis suffix say? Split or rupture, right? So ultimately, once you've grown the blood vessel lining back, you get rid of the clot by breaking it down, because if it stays in place, you have a thrombus. But if it breaks free and is on the move, you now have an embolism. So where are some common places for embolisms to hit?
Lungs and brain.
Lungs and brain, yep. Even can cause heart attacks too. So unfortunately, if that fibrin clot ruptures, then it can move and travel, and that's certainly not a good thing for us. A lot of times heart attacks are simply nothing more than clots that have ruptured from someplace, perhaps even in the heart themselves. And so that repair process, unfortunately, causes bigger problems than it initially set out to. So let's talk about anticoagulants down there near the very bottom of your page. You got your blanks there, right? Okay. You've heard of blood thinners before. So is it actually thinning the blood? No, blood thinners inhibit what process?
Coagulation,
good. So they impair the process of making that fibrin mesh network, and they prevent your blood from turning from a liquid to a gel. So a clot, unfortunately, will not be formed, which may be a good thing depending on the situation. We're going to find out in the next chapter with heart that some people have a condition called atrial fibrillation, and they may throw clots commonly to their brain and cause strokes. So by taking an anticoagulant, they can prevent forming those clots and throwing them to the brain. So common ones are things like aspirin, heparin, which we actually make in small amounts by some of our white blood cells. Warfarin and Coumadin are actually the same thing. One's a generic version of the other. And there's a lot of new drugs in the market you may have heard ads on TV for. Things like Xarelto and Eliquis are new types of anticoagulants. Sometimes they don't have a reversal drug available like these older forms do. So nonetheless, a blood thinner, in fact, does not make the blood less viscous. It makes the blood less likely to form a clot And so clot formation can be a problem in some populations of people, especially those who have, say, AFib. So if you have, say, problems where you make a lot of clots, should you be eating a lot of green leafy foods?
No.
Definitely no. Should you be eating a lot of calcium-rich foods if you have a lot of clots that form? Probably not, yeah. And in fact, some of these medications actually say, hey, don't eat the green leafy vegetables because it fights what we do as drugs. All right, so that should take you down to the bottom of page 28. And you know what? We're back where we started. We're back to the blood typing information. So I want to ask again, is there anything you've got questions on? Blood typing? Good. Okay.
So what is hemophilia? Does that have to do with platelets?
Platelets, more specifically, some of these, we didn't cover all the factors, but part of the factors that turn on this coagulation process are missing. There's 10 different factors. And if they're missing one of them, then the cascading process doesn't follow. So it's like a domino effect, and you take out one of the dominoes, and so you never fully coagulate the blood.
They're free bleeders.
They're free bleeders, exactly. Yeah. So they can actually give them, like, certain factors that they may be missing to help them do blood clotting if needed. Yeah. Natalie. If you have a thrombus or an embolus, that means fibrinolysis didn't complete properly. So yeah, you either got a stationary clot or one that's moving. So yeah, you've got to have the whole process break down for you to prevent those two problems. Yeah. All right. How about any other questions on blood typing, even endocrine? Why don't we take a look at a little bit of the heart information? I know you're working on that in lab. And then Wednesday, we'll do a little heart information. And then if you have questions, we'll do those questions. If not, I'll bring some games with me. So heart information is going to start over a few pages. That's page 35. Blood, heart, and blood vessels all go hand in hand. This particular textbook classifies them as part of the cardiovascular system. So we're going to talk about the heart. This is actually going to be a topic on test number 2, along with the blood vessels. But the heart and the blood vessels certainly go hand in hand as two components of your cardiovascular system. So the heart pumps the blood, and the vessels transport that blood. Let's talk about heart orientation, size, and location. The heart is a fist-shaped organ. It's, not very large. We see those models in lab and kind of get the wrong idea. Some of those models in lab are a little bigger than the typical human heart would be. The pointed apex is going to sit oriented towards your diaphragm and left hip. What about the right side of your heart, the base? Where is that going to sit oriented to? Right shoulder, right. So it's kind of sitting in there a little strangely oriented, right side base going to your right shoulder, pointy apex situated toward your diaphragm and left hip. We know your heart sits in the thoracic cavity. Specifically, it sits in a little cove called what?
Mediastinum.
Good. You can see that snug area there between the two lungs. And so that mediastinum or mediastinum is the location we find the heart sitting in within your thoracic cavity. All right, so let's take a look at your coverings of the heart. Heart coverings, we basically have three different layers here. Let me start you from the outermost of the layers. There is a tough, leathery outer covering to your heart called the fibrous pericardium. It is like wax paper, it's not transparent, but it's meant to provide a tough outer covering to your heart. Now, if you were to peel away your fibrous pericardium, you'd actually be removing one of your two serous membrane layers. Let me take you back to Bio-210 for just a moment. We know that serous membranes are two layers made up of simple squamous epithelium. And what's in between those two layers?
Serous fluid.
Serous fluid, good. What is the function of serous fluid? Shock absorber, lubrication, good. So in this picture, you're actually looking at those two layers around the lung, and here's those two layers around the heart. The outermost of any serous membrane bilayer is called the what layer? Parietal, good. And the deeper innermost layer?
Visceral.
Okay, so let me say again, the outermost membrane around your heart is called the fibrous pericardium. If you were to peel it back, you would actually be taking with you the parietal serous membrane. They're like double-sided gift wrap. Outside is fibrous pericardium, peel it back, on the other side is parietal serous membrane. There's a space between the parietal and visceral layer. What's in that space? Serous fluid, right. This is actually what we call the pericardial cavity, that space between the parietal and visceral layer. And then finally, you get to the visceral layer underneath, and that anchors directly to the heart itself. So the visceral layer is like shrink wrap. You know, when you buy a product that has shrink wrapping on it, that plastic really tightly all over the outside, you can't remove the visceral pericardium without also taking away the heart muscle itself. They're kind of like glued together, so to speak. Okay, so there's in fact three layers. From superficial to deep, we have fibrous, then what? A serous layer that's known as parietal, and one more layer, the deepest one called visceral. Good. Which of those three layers produce serous fluid? Visceral and parietal, yeah. And the fluid is sitting where? In the pericardial cavity between those two, right. So which two layers are glued together? Parietal and fibrous, right? Think of the parietal and fibrous as double-sided gift wrap. The outside is the fibrous portion. Flip it over. The inner portion is your parietal layer. Okay. So here's another look at that setup. From the outside to the inside is fibrous. Right there glued to it is your parietal layer. This dark layer is in fact a space called your pericardial cavity. And then we encounter your visceral layer, which is anchored directly to the heart muscle itself. So those three layers are meant to protect and lubricate around the outside of the heart. In this picture, you're looking at the heart here in the middle, lungs on either side, and they have peeled back the outermost layers, two of them, which is labeled A. So what are you looking at here for letter A? Good. Fibrous was peeled back, and you're looking at the parietal layer showing at you, right? You see there's a bit of space in between. And then what is letter B? That's visceral. Good. Okay. Now, on your sheet, there's also walls of the heart. I do want to mention those for just a moment. We'll come back to that. The outermost visceral pericardium is actually a wall for the heart, but it goes by a different name called the epicardium. Okay, so this just got really confusing really fast. Let's go from the outside. Fibrous pericardium, parietal, serous fluid,
visceral.
And visceral has an alternate name. It's epicardium. So it depends on your perspective, right? If you're talking about membranes, it's the visceral pericardium. If you're talking about layers of the heart itself, it's called the epicardium. From there, you travel to the myocardium. Myocardium, of course, is this heart muscle. Heart muscle, you may recall, is different from other muscle tissue. What do you know about myocardium? Intercalated discs, good. What else? Striated, it's... it's actually uni. Yeah, it's one nucleus. It is branched. And interesting about how this stuff works, if you have an impulse spread throughout this tissue, that branched nature allows for the impulse to spread and scatter throughout multiple cells at once. And these intercalated discs, like this one here, allow for that impulse to travel directly from one cell to the next without having to go through any issues. So that means that your heart muscle tissue can work as a coordinated pump rather than having it work as a domino effect where one portion contracts and the other portion is just now getting the message. So the innermost layer, let's go there, is actually called endocardium. It is a type of simple squamous that lines the inside of the heart, and it is, in fact, continuous with the inside of your blood vessels. So endocardium and endothelium are the linings for the insides of the heart and vessels. Okay, so from outside to inside, now we have a lot more to think about. The outermost is your fibrous pericardium, which serous membrane layers anchored to it?
Parietal,
good. What is next?
Serous
fluid in that pericardial space. And another serous membrane known as?
Visceral.
Now, visceral has another name depending on your perspective. It is?
Epicardium.
Good. And so epicardium and visceral pericardium are the same thing. And then we come to myocardium. And the deepest of all layers is?
Endocardium.
Good. Let me take you to this issue here called cardiac tamponade or heart plug or cardiac effusion. That's one thing you're going to find about this chapter is that one condition may go by three or more different names. So this particular condition is characterized by having excess fluid between what two layers?
Parietal
and visceral. Good. So what do you think that does to the heart if you fill that space with a lot of fluid? Puts a squeeze on it, right? So this fluid could be things like blood or pus, even excess serous fluid. And in fact, if you do put the squeeze on the heart, you're going to reduce the amount of fluid or blood the heart itself can pump. So what do you think some symptoms are? How do you think you would feel if you have this condition? Like you can't breathe, squeezing around your heart. I think most people would probably basically scared they had a heart attack, right? So this squeezing around the heart, this excess fluid can be drained by a syringe. Ouch, I'd hate to be tasked with that job. Okay, so that syringe can draw off the excess fluid, whether it's pus or blood or even excess serous fluid. So this can come from a number of things. Sometimes a really bad heart attack can cause the heart muscle to tear. Blood can leak from inside the heart through the heart wall layers and into that serous membrane around the outside of the heart. In other cases, we may see cancer or inflammation around the heart, or even cardiac surgery can irritate those layers and cause fluids to accumulate. This is more than just simply inflammation. This is a lot of fluid that gathers and puts the squeeze on the heart activity. I'll tell you an easy way to remember this. Tampons soak up fluid, right? Okay? So cardiac tamponade, you would like to have something to soak up that fluid. So that may be an easy way to keep this one straight. How about questions so far?
What exactly is the serous pericardium?
It is two layers. It is both parietal and visceral. So when you say serous pericardium, my brain wanders to thinking two layers. So it is, in fact, the parietal layer that's anchored to the fibrous outer one, and it's also this visceral one here that's anchored to the heart itself. Does that make sense?
Not yet.
Imagine if I take gift wrap paper and I wrap my box twice. The first wrapping is my visceral wrapping, and then I'm gonna wrap my box again a second time, and that second layer is actually double-sided gift wrap, and the outermost piece that I actually see is the fibrous pericardium. So it'd be like taking my birthday gift and wrapping it with two layers of gift wrap.
Okay, well,
it'd
be double-sided, so the other side would be the
parietal, yeah. So by double-sided gift wrap, that's your outermost layer, and then just normal gift wrap is your innermost wrapping. Okay. Kayla. Parietal pericardium? It's actually just the outer of the two serous membranes. Those serous membranes actually fold and wrap in on themselves. So the parietal is the outermost of the two. And if you were to label your fibrous pericardium, it would go around the outside here. Say that again. If you peel it back, the fibrous and the parietal are glued together, and then you've got visceral and then myocarditis and the other questions?
What are the two blanks at the bottom?
Yeah.
Two blanks at the bottom.
Is that, because it says inflammation, would that be inflammation like the pericardium? Is that inflammation of the pericardium?
That's right.
Okay, so I do have it right. Did it be like inflammation of the endocardium? Okay.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought so, because I always remember itis means it's the inflammation like appendicitis.
Exactly right.
Okay.
Good. Bottom of your page, you've got two issues down there, pericarditis and endocarditis. Pericarditis, you're exactly right, is inflammation of the pericardium. And that could be fibrous or serous in nature. Now, usually when something gets inflamed, it swells. And so if you have a swollen membrane around the outside of your heart, how do you think you would feel? Chest pain. Yeah, maybe difficulty breathing. And so what can happen is a person may smoke, and the smoke may irritate the lungs, and the lungs may develop pleurisy, which is an inflammation of those serous membranes. That inflammation can then travel to the heart and cause pericarditis. So what the problem is you have to get rid of the root cause, such as stopping smoking, in order to get rid of the inflammation. So smoking can do this. Bacterial infections can do it, even cancer can do it, and it certainly is a pain every time the heart beats because it's rubbing against swollen membrane layers. So they got to treat the root underlying cause, whatever it may be. Endocarditis is a nasty little situation. This is inflammation of what?
Endocardium,
exactly. So this is a picture of a bacterial endocarditis. You can see the chordae tendineae here. And of course, some of this looks like it's not in a very good condition. So things like streptococcus infections can cause endocarditis. So that's why you don't want to let certain infections just linger on and hope that they clear, because they can cause really serious conditions like inflammation inside the heart. All right, so that takes us down to the bottom of the page. Do you have any other questions there? You good to go with pericardiums? Still, we can hit it again Wednesday if need be. Just remind me. I'll bring my gift wrap. We'll wrap up a heart. Okay. Let me flip you on over to page 36. Just want to give you a little bit of heart anatomy background. I know you guys have covered this in lab. This is going to be a big repeat for you. At the very top of your page, there are four chambers of the heart, two atria that are superior and two ventricles that are inferior. Let me just repeat the issue here. Atrium is a single chamber, while atria is what?
Both
double. Yeah, both are plural. So if you're talking about the right side, that right chamber specifically is the right atrium. Right atria is not right because that implies two of those chambers, two or more. So there is a right atrium, of course, anatomically, and a left atrium. And then we have the right ventricle, and we've got the left ventricle. The catch is, keep in mind, we're dealing with anatomical positions, so the left and right ears are backwards to you as the viewer. Okay, so you'll notice that the right atrium receives blood from three veins. They are the coronary sinus, not visible here. This blood vessel, SVC, or superior vena cava. And what about this one? Inferior vena cava, good, or IVC. Do these blood vessels carry oxygenated blood or deoxygenated blood?
Deoxygenated,
good. This blood flows from these three veins back into the, whoops, right atrium of the heart. There we go. And so the right atrium does, in fact, receive deoxygenated blood. And this blood happens to be under low pressure. At the very same time, blood is flowing into the left atrium from four veins. What are they? Pulmonary. Good. So pulmonary veins are bringing blood back from which organs? The lungs. Is this oxygenated or deoxygenated blood?
Oxygenated.
Good. So you know the trick, right? Arteries are red, veins are blue. Pulmonary switch the two. Right. So of course, pulmonary veins are not blue, they're red, and they do carry oxygenated blood, which is not the norm for a vein. So blood flows simultaneously into the right atrium and into the left atrium through these open valves down to these two ventricles before being ejected from the heart. Where does this right ventricle send blood? Pulmonary trunk. Good. And of course, that is a blue artery. It's taking deoxygenated blood where? To the lungs. Good. The left ventricle over here sends blood through this large artery, which in fact is red. It is what?
Aorta.
Aorta. Good. And it takes blood to the body everywhere. Good. Okay. Now, there are two walls here. You've got a wall that separates the atria and down here the ventricles. These walls are called septum. And of course, they're meant to divide the heart into, excuse me, left and right sides. You may notice that this wall, along with the outer wall of the left ventricle, makes that left ventricle appear really muscular. Why is that the most muscular of our chambers? Right, got to pump the blood out to the body. So it is not only the largest chamber, it is also the most muscular chamber. Okay. So this looks like a good place to stop with the coronary sulcus. That is a groove around the front side of the heart where blood vessels lay. Why don't we pick up with the four valves on Wednesday? Do bring your questions, anything you need to hear. And if you don't bring any, we'll play some games.